I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the second half of my interview with Professor William Church, a neuroscientist here at Trinity College, on the topic of religion and science and their relationship. For the first half of this interview, go to IEET.org. This morning I was listening to a podcast about a debate that occurred between Leibniz and two theologians sometime in the late 17th century. I think it was in Paris. At any rate, Leibniz... It was the one who coined the phrase, the best of all possible worlds. And the argument that they were having was about why is there suffering, theodicy. In fact, I learned this morning that Leibniz coined the term theodicy, which is why is there suffering in the world if God is omnipotent, omniscient, and benevolent? You know, for a truly omnipotent, omniscient being and benevolent, they wouldn't make us all suffer. And Leibniz was saying, well, given those three conditions, the world has some purpose, which we can't understand, and ultimately, of all the possible worlds that could have been created, the purpose that God intended for the universe will be best fulfilled by this one. So he wasn't saying that it's the best of all possible worlds for every single individual, which was what Voltaire later caricatured with with Candide, but he was saying that whatever that ununderstandable purpose is, we have to have these particular sets of laws in place. And it was interesting because, you know, science was just bubbling up at that time. So one of the ideas that he proposed and that they were debating was, well, perhaps, you know, God is not an intervener. So this was called deism at the time, the idea that there are no more miracles. Maybe there are miracles once, but there are no more miracles. God set up the rules of the universe, and it works like clockwork, and he's not reaching in and helping one person or another. So is that an attractive, you know, is your God an interventionist? or is the God that you're thinking about or trying to relate to someone who actually could come and help you win the lottery?
No, he could not do that. The God that I'm beginning to understand is a God that is... always beside me, allowing me to be a player in the game of life, as opposed to a spectator, which is my interpretation of an intervener. I think that he, Barbara talks about the idea that God created the laws of nature and then let the laws of nature take over, and that to me is a very attractive kind of outlook with regards to my enjoyment as a scientist. And so the God that I am striving to know better really is one that is present when I need him or her, but is not going to help me win the lottery. And praying to win the lottery is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. God is much bigger than that, and saying a prayer before I walked into this interview, that was going to help. I had a feeling, but I'll never win the lottery because God said so.
The notion of a God that cares about human beings made a heck of a lot more sense before we understood that there are 10 billion suns with, 10 billion possible planets in this galaxy, and then there's 100 billion or however many galaxies out there. Given our growing scientific understanding of the vastness of the universe, its vast emptiness, the vast numbers of intelligent species that there may be out there, doesn't it seem hubristic for this tiny speck of protoplasm to think that anything cares about us?
I don't think so. I think where we tend to fall short is when we think that we are the only ones worthy of being God's creation. There are probes that have been flying around for, 25 years, and they're going to be sending back data very shortly about whether or not there's more than one universe. Mm-hmm. And so the question is will the message say that God created the universes instead of the universe?
Multiverse.
Multiverses, right.
Yeah.
I think it's very egotistical of us to say, well, there's no other intelligent whatever that is. Some people would argue that I don't know that we're intelligent life at all, given our current state of affairs. Mm-hmm. But that we should be God's only creation. I think that's very narcissistic.
Doesn't that change your understanding? Like for Mormons, I talked to Mormons last week. For Mormons, they are fully behind the idea that there's lots of planets out there and each planet has its own God. They're not strictly speaking monotheists because, mm-hmm. They see this proliferation of gods around the world. But at any rate, if Jesus Christ becoming man may have had a special significance for us, was Glorp becoming Glorplik, the special significance for somebody else? So you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that accepting the existence of Jesus Christ on Earth here as an event that occurred as a result of God's desire to reestablish his relationship with fallen man, that's wonderful. That happened here. Does that mean it's exclusive to our planet because we're special? Mm-hmm. My spirituality says that my God may be bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on this book. It's called The Glory is in the Guessing. And it's literally, who knows? Why you can't put limits on, at least I can't. I can't put limits on the size of my God and what it can result as a function of his purpose for me on this earth. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that is happening on planet Gorp with the Gorpettes, that's fine and dandy. That doesn't diminish my God at all, as mm-hmm. From my standpoint.
But it means that there could be other gospels with other,
sure,
with other creatures.
I don't.
Does it change your relationship to the uniqueness of Christianity? Are you someone who thinks that that all faiths lead to the same place?
That's Christianity's gotten such the term or the title of being a Christian has gotten such a bad rap historically that I call myself a follower of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Because the way of life that he desires us to live as defined in his teachings in the New Testament are the way I want to live my life.
Mm-hmm. I hope your wife's okay with giving away all your property and wandering around with a bunch of men. Your students may be a little disappointed as well.
That was only for a very special few. I wasn't able to do that. I don't think he's asked me to do that. It would be cool if he did, though. Is there the different... again, the presence of different religions and how they relate to what my interpretation of my God is something that I'm working on right now. I am not the Episcopal Church. I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and obviously they've had lots of issues right now. I do believe that man can only be reconnected with God by his belief in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
How that manifests itself, it may be different for different people. Again, and I claim ignorance for many, many, seriously significant ignorance of many, many religions, and that's one of those goals in my bucket list, if you will, that I need to become more learned in the teachings of other religions to have a better understanding of that relationship, of the relationship between my God and their God.
Looking back at the Big Bang, I'm sure you've run across this argument that the preconditions, the 35 different constants that our universe were set at, are in such a narrow range of probability that that for some seems to be evidence that it was in fact a created and intentional act, the creation of this particular universe. And others say, no, you know, in a multiverse, the fact that we exist in the one of the few universes in which intelligent, self-aware life could exist is simply, well, where else could we exist?
Right,
that's the place we exist.
We exist because we can.
Right. So, you know, for me, I like apparently you, contemplating things like the multiverse is so mind-blowing, it's almost a religious experience for me. But it seems, if you were open to a notion like a multiverse, that God created a multiverse, it seems to like radically screw up some of our ideas about intentionality. So if, you know, you're God and you say, I'm going to create a space of possibilities in which virtually everything will happen, right? So,
right.
Well, what's the humor behind that? What possible purpose could there be in saying, well, I'm going to create, you know, 95% of the universes, they will immediately collapse in on themselves as because the constants aren't right. And only in this very narrow range will there be universes that actually work.
Right. Well, that's a wonderful point, and it reminded me of, I don't recall the reading, but the idea that we have multiple realities, mm-hmm. and that after each decision that we make, that changes or alters the reality that we now exist in. And it sort of goes along with the multiple universes.
A quantum
right, exactly.
Expansion.
And so that there's a possibility for your individual existence in everything. And depending on what decision what you have for breakfast in the morning and how long it takes you to eat that breakfast, that defines the next reality that you're going to exist in on a moment-to-moment basis. And this is, again, this is some very interesting ideas that I am excited to be able to pursue. I certainly am not well read in them at this point in my, investigation.
That there has to be, for every one of us out there, some of us who achieved the worst possible lives that we could have achieved, and some of us who achieved the best possible lives. So,
well, that's all relative.
And that's all relative,
I think, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the
grace
disappeared.
Grace or good works?
Grace.
Grace. Okay, so you're a good Protestant about that, huh?
Yes. But grace without good works is...
But not predestination, I hope.
No.
Okay, good.
No, absolutely not.
Tell me, how are the students receiving it? Are any of them being challenged?
I hope so. There are a couple that have written some really, for the first year seminars, that have written some really probing papers. And there are, I think, probably some of the more interesting class discussions that we've had are when students are challenged to defend or argue for, actually, defend is not the right word, to argue for their belief system that they've had, you know, since they were 3 or 4 years old and mom and dad took them to church every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, and there are circumstances, you know, I had one student come up to me and said, you know, Dr. Church, it just doesn't, you can't change people's opinions about this kind of stuff. And I commented, you know, well, it's not really about changing opinions. It's about learning whether or not the argument is valid. And so I think the students, you know, as a means to get the students to begin to understand and develop and evaluate arguments, as well as learn a little bit of science along the way, I think it's been a successful first year seminar, and I can't wait to teach it again.
Students are becoming increasingly secular. I've been asking students since I came here, and we've been asking since the 70s, first years, what their religious beliefs are. And back in the 70s, about... I think it was 10% said that they were non-believers. And today it's up to about 30% mm-hmm. of first years. And one of the things that people have long suspected about higher education, you know, people who have gone through higher education tend to be more secular. And so exposure to this world of ideas tends to make people question their beliefs. Now, This is partly because the nature of most religious belief systems is inflexible in regard to these things that you're, these issues that you're grappling with. So like Julia Sweeney's classic example, she went back, explored her Catholic faith, actually read the Bible and said, I cannot believe people believe any of this crap.
Right, right, exactly.
and gave it all up. Well, you're starting from a different point of view. You're saying, you know, there's a set of experiences, a set of relationships that you can have to the universe, which are completely independent of the literal truth of these documents. So starting from there, how do we do that? So are students finding that inspiring, or are they still, in this dialogue, are they still finding their traditional religious beliefs, you know, crumbling?
I would say that as a scientist, my data set is too small at this point.
What is it, 10?
12, right.
Okay, 12. Yeah.
12. And some of them more, you know, are more forthcoming with their opinions. I would say, you know, from that limited number of individuals, I would say that that this group seemed to have, you know, as they are freshmen, I think they're just beginning to be able to question, you know, as I didn't do until I was 35 years old, you know, really go back and analyze, read the Bible and say, you know, why do people, you know, this really can't be what people think. And we, you know, we still struggle.
Your daughter's raped, you have to stone her.
Yeah, I know. Some of that stuff is a little out there.
Yeah.
And so the idea of causing a person to begin to ask questions is one of the more rewarding aspects of this job, and certainly of this class, mm-hmm. because there are questions that they, I don't think, have thought that they were allowed to ask while they were living at home and growing up in whatever the environment that they were. And so I think that hopefully, as a result of this class, it may be a catalyst for them to further investigate their belief system and help them find a compass that says, in my search for the ultimate truth, am I on the science end of it, or am I on the religious, theological end of it? Or is there an in-between that I can draw from both fields to make me get closer to my understanding of that ultimate truth?
Well, I appreciate your candor, and I'm sorry if there's any trepidation coming in. I promise very few people will ever hear your confession.
Oh, it wasn't. I was excited. I was excited. I'm very honored to be asked to do this, and you know, I hope I didn't come across as being too confused about where I am, but it's a journey that I've just started on, and it's amazingly exciting given the possibilities that exist for me to further develop my spiritual understanding and my spiritual compass, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, my audience has heard a lot about this dialogue over time, so I don't think they'll be too taken aback by anything you had to say.
Okay.
And also to say, you know, my own, although I don't, for me, a creator God is not part of my spiritual framework, you know, I'm grappling in a similar way with, you know, issues like reincarnation and topics that you know, seem to some who are in my faith tradition to be very central, and that don't seem central to me. And so how to put together the scientific and the religious has been a long time question.
Yes. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, great. Thanks so much for coming in today. I've been speaking with William Church. He's a professor of chemistry and neuroscience here at Trinity College, and you can find him on the Trinity College website.
Thank you very much, Jay. Yeah. I appreciate it.
This has been the second half of my interview with Professor William Church on the relationship of religion and science. Dr. Church is a neuroscientist here at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Since the Republicans and the Tea Party won control of the U.S. House of Representatives back this week, it was a welcome piece of positive political news, so far as I and some folks of the IAT are concerned. that the Obama administration has decided to change the federal government's course on the issue of gene patents, human gene patents. And so on October 29th, this policy was reversed. And here I'm going to read Andrew Pollack from the New York Times. Reversing a longstanding policy, the federal government said on Friday that human and other genes should not be eligible for patents because they are part of nature. The new position could have a huge impact on medicine and on the biotechnology industry. The new position was declared in a friend of the court brief filed by the Department of Justice late Friday in a case involving two human genes linked to breast and ovarian cancer. We acknowledge that this conclusion is contrary to the longstanding practice of the Patent and Trademark Office, as well as the practice of the National Institutes of Health and other government agencies that have in the past sought and obtained patents for isolated genetic DNA. The brief said, it's not clear if the position in the legal brief, which appears to have been the result of discussions among various government agencies, will be put into effect by the Patent Office. If it were, it's likely to draw some protests from some biotechnology companies that say such patents are vital to the development of diagnostic tests, drugs, and the emerging field of personalized medicine, in which drugs are tailored for individual patients based on their genes. It's major when the United States, in a filing, reverses decades of policies on an issue that everyone has been focused on for so long, says Edward Raines, a patent attorney who represents biotechnology companies. The issue of gene patents has long been a controversial and emotional one. Opponents say that genes are the products of nature, not inventions, and should be the common heritage of mankind. They say that locking up basic genetic information in patents actually impedes medical progress, while proponents say that genes isolated from the body are chemicals that are different from those found in the body. Even just repeating their argument is so totally absurd. But anyway, genes isolated from the body are chemicals that are different from those found in the body and therefore are ineligible for patents. That's like saying, if I copy your book out onto papyrus instead of onto paper, well, it's not your book anymore because now it's on papyrus. It's not on paper anymore. So it's like a completely absurd argument. But anyway, the Patent and Trademark Office has sided with the proponents and issued thousands of patents on genes of various organisms, including on an estimated 20% of human genes. But in its brief, the government said it is now believed that the mere isolation of a gene without further alteration or manipulation does not change its nature. The chemical structure of native human genes is the product of nature, and it is no less a product of nature when that structure is isolated from its natural environment than are cotton fibers that have been separated from cotton seeds or coal that has been extracted from the earth, said the brief. However, the government suggested such a change could have limited impact on the biotechnology industry because man-made manipulations of DNA, like methods to create genetically modified crops or gene therapies, could still be patented, which is what we've said all along. Dr. James P. Evans, a professor of genetics and medicine at the University of North Carolina, who headed a government advisory task force on gene patents, called the government's brief a bit of a landmark, kind of a line in the sand. And let's hope it actually is. And let's hope that the Obama administration sticks to their guns. There was a drop in the market the last time a U.S. and England briefly suggested under Clinton and Clinton and the previous Labor government that that there might be a change in their patent policy to renege on human gene patents, and the biotech market took a hit. So we'll see if they can stand up to that kind of scrutiny. Now, more on gene news this week. Researchers find a liberal gene. I mean, thank God, when this time when we're all disappearing, we can now go around and surreptitiously slip people the liberal gene. And this is from a press release from this group of researchers. Liberals may owe their political outlook partly to their genetic makeup, according to new research from the University of California, San Diego, and Harvard University. Ideology is affected not just by social factors, but also by a dopamine receptor gene called DRD4. The study's authors say this is the first research to identify a specific gene that predisposes people to certain political views. Appearing in the latest edition of the journal Politics, published by Cambridge University Press, the research focused on 2,000 subjects from the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health. By matching genetic information with maps of the subject's social networks, the researchers were able to show that people with a specific variant of the DRD4 gene were more likely to be liberal as adults, but only if they had an active social life in adolescence. So this is an interesting interaction effect here. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter affecting brain processes that control movement, emotional response, and ability to experience pleasure and pain. Previous research has identified a connection between a variant of this gene and novelty-seeking behavior, and this behavior has previously been associated with personality traits such as political liberalism. So in other words, if you like new foods, new peoples, new cultures, new ideas, you're liberal. And if you don't, you're conservative. Now, here's the complicating interaction effect. Lead researcher James Fowler hypothesized that people with the novelty-seeking gene variant would be more interested in learning about their friends' points of view. As a consequence, people with this genetic predisposition who have a greater than average number of friends would be exposed to a wider variety of social norms and lifestyles, which might make them more liberal than average. They reported that it is the crucial interaction of two factors, the genetic predisposition and the environmental condition of having many friends in adolescence, that is associated with being more liberal. The research team also showed that this held true independent of ethnicity, culture, sex, and age. Fowler concludes that the social and institutional environment cannot entirely explain a person's political attitudes and beliefs, and that the role of genes must be taken into account. These findings suggest that political affiliation is not based solely on the kind of social environment that people experience, said Fowler. It is our hope that more scholars will begin to explore the potential interaction of biology and environment. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.